we approach President's Day, Americans remember our founders and framers, but the greatest of them all gets little mention because he never occupied the Oval Office, more's the pity. Although he was almost 40 years older than Thomas Jefferson and John Adams when the three of them sat down together to write the Declaration of Independence, Ben Franklin seems a little bit younger and hipper than either of them. George Washington seemed formal and austere even to his contemporaries. He was usually addressed as Your Excellency, while Franklin just went by nicknames. He was called Old Ben, or as Adams called him, the Old Conjurer. A lifelong inventor and tinker, he would have been amazed and amused, but right at home in this world of smartphones and gadgets, no prude. He had an attitude towards sex that would have made him right at home in his times. Celebrated by his contemporaries as a revolutionary who stole lightning from the skies and the scepter from tyrants, he wore his celebrity and greatness with a casual air. Never forgetting his humble origins, he was comfortable with commoners as well as kings, not so much a man of the 18th century as a figure for the ages. His name, Franklin, came from Middle English, where it meant free man. This term applied to the classes that were neither serfs nor titled aristocrats. They were tradesmen, they were artisans who managed by their own talent and toil to rise in the world, to gain a share of political power. His distant ancestors were ardent Protestants who, during the reign of the Catholic Queen Mary, took a forbidden English Bible, tied it underneath a stool where it could be hidden, turned over and read aloud, then hidden again when there was any sign of danger. By Ben's time, the family's religiosity had cooled considerably, although Franklin claimed in his autobiography that it was for freedom of religion that his ancestors came to this country. Economic motives also played a role. Wages here were two or three times higher than they were in Britain. This enabled his father, Josiah, to earn his living as a tallow chandler, turning animal fat into soap and candles, making enough money to support his 17 children. But not enough to take them all into the family business. The original plan had been that Ben was going to study for the ministry. He was enrolled in Boston Latin, preparing for Harvard and eventual ordination, but either the cost of a Harvard degree proved to be too expensive, or more likely, the father decided that his son was insufficiently pious for this vocation. You may have noticed that young Ben was fidgety during the long prayers at meal times one fall day when his father was preparing provisions for the winter, salting away a barrel. His son had some practical advice. Dad, I think if you said a prayer over the whole cask all at once, it would be a great savings. Not long after that, after just 2 years of formal schooling, very little education, it was decided that he would go to work as an apprentice for his older brother, who had set up shop for himself as a printer. Now, he'd been given a chance to examine other trades with his father. He'd walked around town, he'd seen the silversmiths, he'd seen the barrel makers, the cutlers grinding their knives. He always had a sense of affinity, admiration, respect for the laboring classes, people who worked with their hands, who knew how to use tools. This laid a groundwork for his own technological innovations, for the bifocals, the first electrical battery, of course, the Franklin stove that came out of his home workshop. But he finally settled on printing as a vocation, and it was probably his love of books that took him in this direction. Many, many years later, there was a town in Massachusetts that named itself after Franklin. They asked him to donate a bell for their local church. He told them to forget the church, abandon the steeple, build a library instead, was his advice. Books being preferable to a bell, sense being preferable to sound. Besides access to the written word, running a printing press gave Ben an opportunity to write, to try his hand at composition, because printers in those days were also, they were authors and journalists entering into all the fray of political debate. He taught himself composition by studying the classic English essayists like Swift and Addison. He would try to frame an essay on the same topic, then compare his results with the originals, usually deeming them poor by comparison. But he said, I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that in certain particulars of small import, I was lucky enough to improve the method of the language and encouraged in this way to think that I might possibly in time come to be a tolerable English writer. He wasn't only tolerable. From his first appearance in print under the pseudonym of Silence Do-Good, writing when he was 16 years old, posing as a middle-aged matron, commenting in a gossipy way on the manners and foibles of her Boston neighbors, on up through the 145 editions of Poor Richard's Almanac that appeared during his lifetime. He was the most popular writer of his day. He developed his own folksy form of humor that became an American trademark. Fishing visitors stink in 3 days was one of his proverbs. Three can keep a secret if two of them are dead. His wit could be light or sharp by turns. While his exact contemporary, Jonathan Edwards, was composing sermons on sinners in the hands of an angry God, Ben Franklin was composing mock scientific articles on intelligent design. Take the human elbow. If the joint had been placed farther down or up our limb, how difficult it would be to bring a wine glass to our lips. Obviously, the Creator's plan. He wasn't religious in a conventional sense. Attending one church, he was disgusted with the preaching whose aim, he said, seemed rather to make us good Presbyterians than good citizens. He did go to Unitarian services from time to time. In 1774, he was present at the founding of the Essex Street Chapel in London. Then, when his friend and fellow scientist Joseph Priestley was forced to flee England for the colonies during the Revolution, Franklin was occasionally a worshiper at the church Priestley founded in Philadelphia. He was himself not averse to formal prayers. When the Constitutional Convention seemed deadlocked, close to breaking down in the kind of partisan bickering we're familiar with. An elderly Franklin restored a gravitas and civility to the proceedings by invoking the Father of Lights to illuminate the gathering. But he always believed that God was better served by good works than by any amount of intercessions. His creed was simple and practical. In a letter to the Reverend Ezra Stiles of Yale near the end of his life, he stated, "I believe in one God, creator of the universe, that he governs it by his providence, that he ought to be worshipped, that the most acceptable service we render to God is doing good to his children." These were the tenets that he thought were essential to all great religions. Everything else was optional in his opinion. As to Jesus, he commented, "I think the system of morals and his religion as he left them to us, the best the world has ever seen or is likely to see, but I apprehend it's received various corrupting changes. And I have, with most of the present dissenters in England, some doubts as to his divinity, though it's a question I do not dogmatize upon, having never studied it, and think it needless to busy myself with it at this advanced age when I expect soon an opportunity of knowing the truth with less trouble." He seemed little interested in metaphysical questions when there were so many more fascinating topics to be studied here on Earth. As a young man on his first trip across the Atlantic, he'd studied the behavior of dolphins, he'd charted the ship's position at sea by using a lunar eclipse, he made medical investigations, he was one of the first to suggest that flu might be spread by contagion, as he called it, anticipating the germ theory of disease. He can fairly be credited with creating the science of weather prediction, hypothesizing that a warm air rising in the south might create little pressure zones drawing in winds from the north. But it's for his discoveries in the realm of electricity that he's best remembered. Up until then, electricity had been vaguely understood as the result of competing fluids, vitreous and resinous, but Franklin explained it as the result of positive and negative charges, famously suggesting that lightning was no different in essence than the sparks that experimenters were then generating in their labs by rubbing on glass tubes. And this was a tremendous breakthrough, as we sang in our hymn this morning, "From Time Out of Mind." Thunderbolts had been regarded as signs of God's work, and especially God's displeasure. Every time a storm approached, the bell ringers would go into the belfries and begin to toll the church bells. There were hundreds of bell ringers electrocuted just over the course of Franklin's lifetime. The lightning seems to strike steeples of choice at the very time the bells are ringing, he noted. And still they continue to bless the new bells and jangle the old ones whenever it thunders. One would think it was time to try some new trick. Of course, he invented the lightning rod. He never patented it, though, never expected any profit from any of his creations. As we enjoy great advantages from the invention of others, we should be glad to have an opportunity to serve others by any invention of ours, he said sincerely. This was a sentiment in keeping with a long life of public service. The good that people can do singly, he thought, it's very small compared to what they can do together. So his greatest achievements were in organizing groups of people around common ends. Early on, he helped to establish the first circulating library in this country. He founded the University of Pennsylvania, the first non-sectarian institution of higher learning in the United States. He organized fire brigades. He had plans for lighting city streets, right down to the design of street lamps that would be cheap and easy to maintain. A better street light might be a small convenience, he granted, but it was through a little improvements like these that human happiness progressed. Good government was not least among the improvements that made for human happiness, and the better part of his life was spent in statecraft. Thanks to his up-by-the-bootstraps background, he was among the most egalitarian, the least elitist of America's founders. He hardly ever wore those powdered wigs that were the high fashion among gentlemen. He preferred instead the rustic cap of the backwoodsman. When his daughter Sally sent him a newspaper article about the proposal to found something called the Order of the Cincinnati that would be a hereditary caste for officers of the Revolution and their descendants, he ridiculed the idea. He favored direct elections. By the end of his life, he'd become a fierce opponent of slavery. His last public act was sponsoring a petition to Congress calling for abolition. He thought excessive wealth should be taxed heavily and put to work for the common good. A man had a right to whatever material goods were necessary for his own maintenance, but beyond that, he said, all property superfluous to such purposes is the property of the public. Although he did as much as anyone to gain the nation's independence by winning French support at the crucial moment, he regarded his role in brokering a peace with Britain as even more important, coining a phrase when he said, there never was a good war or a bad peace. He was a mediator, he was adept in the arts of reconciliation, compromise, using charm, flattery to bring antagonists together. For this, some regarded him as a manipulator, but it was a style he intentionally cultivated. Achieving his aims by indirection, he found, was often the way things got done in this world. He accomplished more than most people during his 84 years, and though his faith in eternity might seem nebulous to some, it did bring him comfort. So when his final illness struck, he was ready to depart. His daughter dutifully expressed a hope that he might live on many more years, but Franklin calmly replied, I hope not. And his wish was quickly granted. His children and grandchildren nearby. When he was a young man, just over 20, he had composed his own epitaph. The words reflected the mix of irony and amusement with which he regarded most matters of faith. The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents worn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lie here food for worms. But the work shall not be lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, revised and corrected by the author. But while Franklin acknowledged a divine author, he was also very much the author of his own life, among all his inventions, his greatest invention was himself. He was a first edition. He was an American original.